The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine will be from the July 7, 2025 edition. As usual, Time's front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in gray, superimposed upon a portrait that is also blotched by glued-on paper. It looks like an Ayatollah pictured on the cover. It's a gentleman with gray and white facial hair. He's wearing glasses, and he's wearing what I call a black turban. That may not be the proper terminology. He's looking at the camera, but part of his face in this photograph is obscured by this kind of pasted paper effect. It's almost like a collage. So moving into the text, under the topic World, Arms, and the Man, for NATO Chief Mark Rutte, R-U-T-T-E, getting Europe to pay more for its defense may be the easy part, by Adam Rosmi, Brussels. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte keeps a variety of mementos in his office. There is a sprawling photograph of the North Sea from the vantage point of his hometown in the Netherlands, a kanji gift from Japan's Minister of Defense, and a framed floral embroidery that reads, "In unity is strength," in Cyrillic, with the stitched flags of NATO, Ukraine, and the EU. But the room's largest ornamental feature is the blue and white map of the world that looms above his conference desk. In the past, I was responsible for this, the former Dutch Prime Minister says, pointing to his tiny home country in the northwestern corner of Europe. He extends his arms out to encircle the entire Western Defense Alliance that is home to 1 billion people. And now, he says, with a wry laugh, it is a glimpse of the storms roiling beneath the optimism of the preternaturally cheerful Rutte. We are in the steel and glass NATO HQ on the outskirts of Brussels, completed 8 years ago at a cost of $1.3 billion. Its interlocking buildings meant to evoke fingers clasped together in unity. But on this balmy May afternoon, 5 weeks before a critical summit with the mercurial U.S. President Donald Trump and dozens of other leaders, the question of unity hangs over the alliance. It really is a pivotal moment, Rutte says, after we sit down in his office some 6 short months after he became Secretary General in October. Pivotal may be an understatement. Trump has repeatedly said, most recently in March, that he's not going to defend NATO allies that do not spend enough on their militaries, a threat to the mutual defense commitment at the heart of the alliance. Europeans, awakened to the danger of American inconstancy, are scrambling to spend trillions more on defense in coming years. All the while, Russia's assault on Ukraine grows deadlier by the month, and intelligence from the Baltic states, Denmark, and Germany suggests Moscow could rebuild its armed forces and attack NATO members, Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania, within a few years. Ruta, 58, brings an idiosyncratic mix of experience and personality to the job of saving the Alliance. An amateur concert pianist and part-time high school social studies teacher, the center-right politician was the longest-serving Dutch prime minister in history. In that role, he developed a talent for working with people from across the political spectrum in the Netherlands, Europe, and the U.S. He even gained a reputation as something of a Trump whisperer. Ruta has used those skills while shuttling between European capitals and Washington, D.C., to push for a new defense spending target of 5% of GDP for NATO members. The goal set by the Trump administration is a stretch. About a quarter of the Allies last year failed to reach the current target of 2%. Lurking behind the numbers are hard questions about what European and Canadian allies are capable of on the battlefield. For decades, NATO has depended on the U.S. for mobile land forces, air defense, long-range weapons systems, and the biggest security shield of all, the nuclear umbrella over the continent. NATO does not work without the nuclear umbrella and all the strategic leadership and strategic force capabilities that the U.S. brings, says General Gordon B. Davis, Jr., retired, a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis and former top NATO official. The position of Secretary General is mainly a diplomatic one, with no direct military authority, but Ruta, a workaholic bachelor with no photos of loved ones in his office, seems to be marshaling member states to meet the moment. His most immediate task is ensuring allies rally around the spending push during the June 24-25 NATO summit in his hometown of The Hague. And in that, he is optimistic. I'm really pretty confident that it will be a splash, Ruta says. I see Europeans stepping up. And after that, in its first half century, NATO preserved democracy in post-war Europe, helped defeat the Soviet Union, and served as a synonym for the West. Once Ruta finishes sorting out the books, there awaits the challenge of making sure the alliance remains united and durable for the years to come. Ruta has trained his eyes on the spending target ever since Trump first floated it in January. He's keeping up the push in the weeks before the summit. Getting Europe to pay up may be the most important step in preventing the transactional Trump from undermining the alliance, but managing him requires its own skills. Ruta has repeatedly said the Trump administration is absolutely right in making more demands of the alliance, and that tone has played well in Washington. Increased European capability would free America up to focus more on China. The U.S. defense budget is continually under pressure. We have real readiness issues after many years of deployment, says Rachel Ellehus, a former advisor to the U.S. NATO mission. The U.S. is facing its own pressures and really needs allies to step up. No matter how quickly they do, few think America's NATO allies could stand up to a direct Russian threat without the U.S., which means all of Ruta's efforts on the budget and capabilities fronts would be for naught if Trump simply decided not to come to the defense of alliance members should the worst come to pass. War and tragedy have loomed over Ruta's life. His father, Isaac, a trader who spent much of his life in Indonesia, then a Dutch colony, survived the Chidang Japanese labor camp. His wife Petronella did not, and Isaac married her sister Mika. They would live in the country until the 1950s. Ruta was born in The Hague in 1967. the youngest of seven children from his father's two marriages. Some siblings are decades older. One brother died from AIDS in the 1980s, an event he once said drastically changed his worldview. I realized I will only live once. There's no dress rehearsal. There's only one performance, Ruta said. That's where my enormous drive comes from. Ruta showed an early interest in politics. He joined the youth branch of the center-right People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, VVD, at 16. Although his ambition was to be a concert pianist, he chose to pursue a degree in Dutch history at Leiden University instead. Ruta calls the piano his great hobby, but is careful not to play past 9 p.m. because of the neighbors living on six sides. Then you get calls. Our children are trying to sleep. And by the way, it was not as good as you thought. He laughs. Ruta rose up the VVD's ranks, becoming national chairman of its youth branch while a student at Leiden. He graduated in 1992 and held a series of human resources jobs at Unilever before taking office as a member of parliament in 2003. Ruta won the VVD leadership position in 2006 and in the 2010 elections led the party to become the largest in parliament for the first time ever. Soon after, he became prime minister, proving himself to be a master coalition builder. Ruta's first government was a coalition with the more right-leaning Christian Democrats, CDA, but was propped up by the far-right Party for Freedom, PVV, led by the anti-Muslim firebrand Geert Wilders. His second, third, and final cabinets included a mix of social democrats, centrists, and conservatives. He's a very capable politician who's able to bring people together, even when they have very different views, says Simon Oitis, a senior assistant professor at Leiden University. Ruta has also been dogged by scandal. His third cabinet resigned in January 2021 following a parliamentary report that found that as many as 10,000 families were forced to repay thousands of euros after they had been wrongly accused of welfare fraud. Another parliamentary report in February 2023 found the Dutch government had for years ignored the risks of drilling gas in Groningen, which had caused man-made earthquakes that damaged homes and affected thousands of lives. Ruta apologized for both scandals. Throughout various controversies, Ruta had a habit of stating he had no active memory of thornier details. He had a more flexible relationship with the truth, Oitis says. The end came in July 2023 when he resigned over a migration fight. But even as his political career waned, the next February he secured a critical endorsement from the U.S. for the top NATO job. The Biden administration considered other candidates, including the more hawkish Kaja Kallas, then Prime Minister of Estonia. But President Biden had liked him, recalls Sean Savet, the former White House National Security Council spokesperson, and Biden and his advisors concluded Kallas was less likely to be able to win over support from some of the Western European allies. Those who know Ruta well expected the job would be a big lifestyle shift for him. He had spent years going to the same hairdresser, visiting the same cafes, eating the same meals at the same restaurants in The Hague. He sometimes drives his closest friends crazy because of all these habits, says Sirk Nooyen, a special advisor to NATO who has worked with Ruta for a decade. Ruta has also kept the same modest apartment in The Hague that he bought with his best friend in his youth. He later shared it with that friend's mother for 20 years until she passed away in 2012 while Ruta was prime minister. Ruta still gets back to The Hague whenever work permits, perhaps in part because of the routines that help keep him grounded. Those include teaching a high school social studies class on Fridays at the Johan de Witt group of schools. I love doing it, Ruta says. It gives you so much energy. The downing of MH17 over Ukraine's Donbas region by Russian-backed forces in July 2014 may have provided the most formative experience to the future NATO Secretary General. The attack claimed 298 lives, 196 of them Dutch. Ruta says that all illusions he may have had about Vladimir Putin were gone after it took 6 nights of calls for the Russian president to agree to help families retrieve the remains of loved ones. And then after that, he never, ever, ever was able to accept that the Russians probably made a mistake. A still visibly shaken, Ruta says, it has to do with basic decency. The tragedy of Ukraine stayed with Ruta ever since. He became one of the most frequent wartime visitors to the country and made his first trip as Secretary General there October 3, just 2 days after taking up the NATO post, meeting Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv. In April, he visited Odessa, a city the Ukrainian president has avoided taking world leaders to since last March, when a Russian ballistic missile struck within hundreds of meters of Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. When asked why he was willing to take the risk of traveling there, he says it was just to make the point that it is not only Kyiv which is under threat. Ruta now helps coordinate outside security assistance to Ukraine, a new responsibility given to NATO by the Biden administration in an attempt to Trump-proof aid. European and Canadian NATO allies have so far this year given more than the estimated $20 billion the U.S. provided in 2024. A German military officer involved in providing support to Ukraine told Reuters that if necessary, Europe can sustain Ukrainian resistance alone. But the war in Ukraine has also underscored the limits of Ruta's power. Almost a year ago, NATO members agreed to an irreversible path for Ukraine to join the alliance. Ruta finds himself in the middle. On the one hand, he says the deal with Kyiv is still standing, but he adds to the disappointment of Ukrainian officials that it does not mean that membership is part of a peace deal, and that is another delicate issue. Ruta has publicly backed the peace talks that grew out of Trump's view of himself as a dealmaker and have at times raised alarm among others in NATO. The Trump administration's approach has been to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than on the aggressor, Russia, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink, said in April before resigning. Ruta says the U.S. president is doing exactly what he needs to do. I really commend him for that, because he broke the deadlock and is constantly engaging with Ukraine and Russia. It helps that Ruta's upbeat. Back at his office, as our interview begins to wind down, the Secretary General repeats a familiar line about the alliance's ability to outpace Moscow if it chooses to. The Russian economy is only 5% of the NATO economy. They are $2 trillion. NATO is $50 trillion. And they produce 4 times as much ammunition as the whole of NATO. 3/4 of a century after its founding, Ruta is confident NATO can fend off any threat from Moscow. I am pretty much convinced we are safe for now, he says, but Russia is reconstituting its armed forces, and Ruta warns of the risk of being complacent. If we do not invest much more, plus get the defense industrial production going, he says, the Russians might try something. Optimism, after all, will get you only so far. That article was slightly abridged. Now for Time Off Movies, a review, Moving Forward from Anguish with Laughs by Stephanie Zakarik. At their best, movies can be subtle expressions of feelings we've had but cannot fully articulate. Besides, when it comes to feelings, articulation might be overrated. One of the functions of art is to explore the undefinable, and sometimes it's a relief to let a movie do some of the emotional heavy lifting for us. That is the function writer, director, star Eva Victor's debut film, Sorry Baby, strives to fulfill. Victor plays Agnes, an academic in her late 20s, who has stuck around in the sleepy college town where she earned her graduate degree. The choice has seemingly paid off. She's landed a full-time teaching job at her alma mater, following in the footsteps of the charming instructor who had advised her on her thesis, a guy with a name straight out of F. Scott Fitzgerald, Preston Decker, Louis Conselmi. Shortly after Agnes starts the job, her closest friend Liddy, Naomi Ackie, an old schoolmate, comes to visit from New York. Liddy has big news of her own. Recently married, she has just learned she's pregnant. Agnes is happy for her, but she also feels abandoned. Liddy is moving on, reshaping her life after grad school in a way Agnes cannot. There's a reason for that. It turns out Agnes was sexually assaulted in her final year of graduate school. Sorry Baby moves backward and forward in time, recounting the events leading up to the assault as well as its aftermath, during which Agnes struggles with the gray areas of sexual trauma. The jumble of anger, guilt, and recrimination the victim is often left to deal with. The event is not dramatized, but Agnes's description of it is filled with anguish, not just because it caused her physical and emotional pain, but because she'd liked and trusted the perpetrator. Maybe she even thought she might be sexually attracted to him, though in a key moment she realized she was not. Victor, in both this performance and the shaping of the film, is not afraid to explore those mixed feelings. Somehow it is expected that all rape victims should feel a certain way. There ought to be unmitigated anger or a thirst for vengeance. Victor treads into subtler territory here. Agnes does not press charges against her rapist, explaining, "I want him to stop being someone who does that. And if he went to jail, he would just be a person who does that who's also in jail." Agnes does not want retribution. She wants the whole thing to have played out differently, to not have been disappointed by a person she trusted. You could quibble Agnes's decision not to press charges and endangers other women, but that is not the point of Sorry Baby. And when you see how she's treated, particularly by two faux feminist campus representatives whose job is ostensibly to help her, her choice is understandable. This is a sort of comedy about personal trauma, a delicate line to walk, and Victor mostly pulls it off. There is comic relief when you least expect it. What can you do when your cat brings you an almost dead mouse? There's no good solution to the problem, though Agnes does her best. Victor and her fellow performers navigate the movie's tone shifts admirably. Ackie, terrific in the title role of the 2022 biopic Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, plays Liddy as the kind of friend who can read your deepest secrets no matter how hard you try to keep them under wraps. She listens with both her ears and eyes. And if Victor at times makes Agnes's awkwardness a little too self-consciously adorable, the actor sparkles quietly in scenes with the shy neighbor, Gavin, Lucas Hedges, who comes by at pre-appointed times for friends with benefits sex. Victor shows how Agnes stops just short of letting herself want too much from any one human being. There's no facile way to get over or get past what happened to her, yet we can see her relearning, step by step, how to move through the world. She has nothing to gain by retreating from it. Another review by Judy Berman, Smoke Sends Mixed Signals. Smoke is on Fridays on Apple TV Plus. Smoke gets off to an insufferable start. Freighted with procedural cliches, the Apple TV Plus thriller follows a mismatched law enforcement duo tracking two prolific arsonists. Dave Goodson, Taron Egerton, is an arson investigator with a standoffish stepson and literary ambitions. His new partner, police detective Michelle Calderon, Journey Smollett, an ex-Marine who's sleeping with a superior. Initial tension gives way to drunken bonding. Pretentious stylistic choices exacerbate the lazy setup. Episodes open with dictionary definitions of thematically appropriate words, transmogrification, on title cards. There are arty shots of billowing infernos. A mournful Tom York song soundtracks the credits. In voiceover, Dave expounds hackily on the annihilating power of fire. After two interminable episodes, a bombshell resets the show, eliminating some of its worst excesses and contextualizing others. Smoke becomes watchable. Yet in its swerve away from one egregious set of tropes, it embraces others that are, if less irritating, almost as tired. An emerging critique of aggrieved, white machismo comes off, mostly as a shallow topical hook. Like so many disappointing Apple TV Plus projects, from Nicole Kidman's Roar to Billy Crystal's Before, the series substitutes marquee names for quality control. Loosely based on the true crime podcast Firebug, it was developed by one of Hollywood's favorite authors, Dennis Lehane. Shutter Island, Mystic River, who helmed Apple's well-received 2022 miniseries Blackbird. The cast includes John Leguizamo, Greg Kinnear, Anna Chlumsky. Natara Guma Mbaho Mwene, a standout in The Chi and Treme, brings a fragile authenticity to the tricky but pivotal role of a maladjusted fast food worker. But the actors are poorly served by the material. Kinnear is miscast as the detective's folksy, complacent boss. Leguizamo's character is too broadly sleazy. Schlumsky's too bland. At the story's forefront, Michelle is a dated, strong female character with a maudlin history of trauma. Egerton, an executive producer, has taken on a role so elastic and so clearly shaped by the need for frequent cliffhangers, it barely holds together. Populated by unhinged men and masochistic women, and punctuated by fiery, increasingly histrionic set pieces, Smoke fails to reconcile its mood of noirish nihilism with its efforts at social commentary. Despite fainting towards subversion, Lehane has produced a typical, overlong, caricature-laden, easy to watch but also to forget, streaming crime show. Under the heading Nation, Social Justice. Caroline Koziol, K-O-Z-I-O-L, says Instagram and TikTok ruined her life. Now she's one of hundreds of plaintiffs fighting back. This is by Charlotte Alter. It's long. It will be abridged. But at the end comes this statement in italics. If you or someone you know needs help, call the National Alliance for Eating Disorders hotline at 866-662-1235 or the National Suicide Prevention hotline at 988. I'll repeat those later. As a freshman in high school, Caroline Koziol competed in the Connecticut statewide championship, swimming the 100-yard butterfly in just over a minute. By senior year, she could barely climb the stairs without seeing black spots. In September 2021, Koziol's coach had to pull her out of the pool after she nearly passed out during swim practice. My coach was like, just eat a granola bar, you'll feel better, says Koziol, now a college junior. And I was like, that's absolutely not going to happen. Back then, Koziol was deep in the grips of an eating disorder that shattered her adolescence. Now she is suing the social media giants Meta and TikTok, alleging the design of their products contributed to her anorexia and made it more difficult for her to recover. When Koziol was stuck at home during the COVID-19 pandemic, she started looking up at-home workouts on social media to keep herself in shape for swimming and searched for healthy recipes to make with her mom. Within weeks, her Instagram and TikTok feeds were full of content promoting extreme workouts and disordered eating. One innocent search turned into this avalanche, she says, sipping iced coffee at a shop near her parents' home in Hartford. It just began to overtake every thought I had. Koziol, now 21, is among more than 1,800 plaintiffs suing the companies behind several leading social media platforms as part of a case that could reshape their role in American society. The plaintiffs include young adults recovering from mental health problems, the parents of suicide victims, school districts dealing with phone addiction, local governments, and 29 state attorneys general. They have joined together as part of a multi-district litigation, MDL, a type of lawsuit which consolidates similar complaints around the country into one case to streamline pretrial proceedings, which is now moving through federal court in the Northern District of California. The plaintiffs allege the products created by social media giants are addictive and dangerous, that the defendants have relentlessly pursued a strategy of growth at all costs, recklessly ignoring the impact of their products on children's mental and physical health, and that young people like Caroline Koziol are the direct victims of intentional product design choices made by each defendant. The MDL is expected to reach trial next spring. It comes as social media is monopolizing more and more attention from children and teens. The average teenager in the U.S. spends nearly 5 hours per day on social media, according to a 2023 Gallup poll. Those who spend more than 3 hours on it daily have double the risk of depression and anxiety. One study found clinical depression among young people was up 60% from 2017 to 2021, which critics attribute partly to rising social media use. Overall, 41% of teens with high social media use rate their mental health as poor or very poor, according to the American Psychological Association. Social media is associated with significant mental health harms for adolescents, wrote former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who argues for putting warning labels on social media platforms, as the U.S. does with tobacco. As some of the most powerful companies in the world work to monetize their attention, kids across the country are struggling with the consequences of social media addiction. They are being stalked by these companies, stalked by these really disturbed values and beauty ideas, stalked by the phone in their hand, says Dr. S. Bryn Austin, a professor of behavioral science at the Harvard School of Public Health. The algorithm is finding them no matter what they are doing. To critics, there is little question why. Austin co-published research which estimated that in 2022 alone, children under 17 delivered nearly $11 billion in advertising revenue to Facebook, Instagram, Snap, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube. Legislative efforts to regulate social media companies have mostly stalled in Congress, and the plaintiff's attorneys in the social media MDL say this case represents the best hope of holding these tech companies accountable in court and getting justice for those who have been harmed. The MDL, says co-lead plaintiff's lawyer Previn Warren of Motley Rice, is a giant coordinated siege by families and AGs, unlike anything we have seen since the opioid crisis. The plaintiffs argue the companies were aware of the ramifications for young users, yet designed their products to maximize addictiveness anyway. Internal documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal in 2021 suggest that Facebook, now Meta, knew Instagram was harming girls' mental health. "We make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls," said one slide presenting internal research. Meta disputes this characterization, saying the same internal research shows teen girls were more likely to say Instagram made them feel better than worse. "These companies knew there was a disproportionate effect on young women," says Koziol's lawyer, Jessica Carroll of Motley Rice. She represents eating disorder clients as young as 13 years old, including some who've been on social media since they were 10. "I think that they experimented on a generation of young people, and we're seeing the effect of that today." Suing social media companies is a difficult challenge. Most digital speech is protected by the First Amendment, and social media platforms have long asserted protections under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which grants them immunity from liability for content they host. But the plaintiffs in the MDL are not suing over content. They're suing on product liability and negligence grounds, alleging defective design features hook children to the platforms and allow them to evade parental consent, while the recommendation algorithms manipulate kids to keep them on the apps. Koziol is not suing Instagram's and TikTok's parent companies for hosting content that drove her to an eating disorder. She is alleging the platforms are designed to maximize her engagement, and as a result, she was drawn deeper and deeper into anorexia content. "If I saw one or two videos, it would not have made a difference," Koziol says. "But when it was all that I was seeing, that's when it became obsessive." Critics say that bombardment is a deliberate feature, not a bug. They have a machine learning recommendation system that is oriented towards growth at all costs, says Carroll, which means anything to keep eyeballs on it. Meta, which owns Instagram, says it has sought to combat the harms experienced by underage users by rolling out new restrictions. As of last year, any Instagram user from ages 13 to 18 will default to what Meta calls a teen account, which is automatically private, limits sensitive content, turns off notifications at night, does not allow messaging with anyone without mutual contacts. The teen accounts are meant to address key concerns parents have about teens on the app, which Meta spokeswoman Liza Crenshaw described as content, contact, and time. Meta has also developed classifiers, she said, AI programs that scan for problematic content to remove. We know parents are worried about having unsafe or inappropriate experiences online, and that's why we have significantly changed the Instagram experience for tens of millions of teens with new teen accounts, Crenshaw said in a statement to Time. These accounts provide teens with built-in protections to automatically limit who is contacting them and the content they are seeing. And teens under 16 need a parent's permission to change those settings. We also give parents oversight over the teens' use of Instagram, with ways to see who their teens are chatting with and block them from using the app for more than 15 minutes a day, or for certain periods of time, like during school or at night. Despite repeated requests, TikTok did not provide a comment for this story. Caroline Koziol's parents thought she was too young for social media as a preteen, but many of her friends in elementary school already had accounts on Instagram and TikTok, and Koziol felt left out. Both platforms have an age limit of 13. Koziol says she signed up when she was 10 or 11. I was able to lie about my age really easily and make an account, she recalls. My parents had no idea. Age verification is an industry-wide challenge, says Crenshaw, adding that this year Meta started testing a new AI tool designed to proactively find accounts of teens masquerading as adults and transition them to teen accounts. Meta supports federal legislation that requires app stores to get parental approval whenever a teen under 16 downloads an app. As a competitive swimmer, Koziol had spent much of her life in a bathing suit and was comfortable in her body. I never thought twice about other people's bodies or my own, she says. What she cared about was her athletic career. Her dream was to swim competitively in college. Then she began spending time on Instagram and TikTok. I started using social media and I'm like, oh, I have really broad shoulders compared to a lot of girls, she recalls, or, oh, my thighs touch, whereas the fitness influencers, their thighs do not. When the pandemic hit, her school went remote and swim practice was canceled. Koziol knew that even a few days away from the pool could weaken her endurance and make her less competitive. Worried about losing muscle mass, she searched on Instagram for 30-minute at-home workout or cardio workout at home. She was also filling free time by baking with her mom and started looking up healthy recipes to make. My searches were never low-calorie, low-fat, Koziol says. It was healthy. The dramatic evolution of the content the algorithm served to her was apparent only in retrospect. It was so nefarious, she says. Searching for healthy recipes led her to low-calorie recipes. Searching for at-home workouts led her to videos of skinny influencers in workout clothes, body-checking for the camera. Something in my algorithm just switched, she says. There was nothing I could do. A healthy teenager who wanted to see memes and funny videos and exchange messages with her friends suddenly had her feed filled with very thin girls in workout clothing showing off their bodies. Before too long, her daily diet shrank to just a protein bar or two. Sometimes she ate nothing at all until dinner. For months, she subsisted mostly on baby puffs and Diet Coke, just to fill my stomach. Even as she forced herself to do hours of cardio. Meanwhile, the algorithm supplied images of skinnier and skinnier girls on more and more extreme diets. Other users chimed in with comments on those posts, Koziol says, suggesting tips and tricks to feel like you're eating something. She kept her car stocked with paper towels, wipes, extra mascara, so she could reapply makeup by forcing herself to vomit on the side of the road. By her junior year, I was addicted to this empty feeling, Koziol says. Being on social media was like getting sucked into a dark hole. She lost 30 pounds in a year. Her eating disorders led to issues with her throat and teeth and hormonal problems that caused hot flashes and night sweats. Her brain felt fuzzy as her short-term memory faltered from malnutrition. I was like a zombie, she says. I was not the same person. Her parents realized something was wrong, and Koziol started outpatient treatment for anorexia the summer after junior year. She met with psychiatrists, dietitians, therapists. Nothing could break the algorithm's grip. When my thoughts correlated with what I was seeing on my phone, it just felt normal, she says. I really didn't see a problem with it. Senior year, she missed half her classes to attend treatment. She was not able to take the AP course load she hoped, and only graduated because of all the extra credits she had taken earlier in high school. Instead of going to college, she went to Monte Nido, an inpatient anorexia treatment facility in Irvington, New York. Toward the end of Koziol's six-week stay at Monte Nido in the summer of 2022, her therapy group had a phone cleansing day. All the patients were asked to either delete social media altogether or to block harmful hashtags. The facility was filled with women of different ages, races, backgrounds, hometowns. But when everyone opened their phones, Koziol noticed their Instagram feeds look just like hers. We have the same creators, she says, the same posts, the exact same content. For all their differences, these women were being fed the exact same pro-anorexia content. It showed me this algorithm does not care about who you are, Koziol says. All they need is that first little search. Even after everything she's been through, Koziol cannot bring herself to delete her social media entirely. Instagram is so ubiquitous it feels impossible to be a young person without it. She has blocked certain hashtags from her Instagram, reset her account, and unfollowed harmful creators. Still, the algorithm finds ways to tempt her. It's taken a lot of work to not interact with the disordered content that occasionally comes up, she says. I always have to remind myself, the second I click on it, I'm going to get another post tomorrow, and then another post tomorrow, and then another post tomorrow. That's the end of the article, which I did abridge. Here again are the phone numbers I mentioned earlier. If you or someone you know needs help, call the National Alliance for Eating Disorders hotline, 866-662-1235, or the National Suicide Prevention hotline, 988. Under the world heading, Viewpoint, Iran's Self-Inflicted Isolation, by Lena Khatib, K K-H-A-T-I-B. Khatib is an associate fellow at Chatham House's MENA program and a visiting scholar at Harvard Kennedy School's Middle East Initiative. It is a perilous moment for Iran. Israel has gained control of the skies. Much of the regime's top military command has been taken out, to say nothing of the civilian toll. U.S. President Donald Trump has called for an unconditional surrender. The Islamic Republic hopes it can persuade the Gulf Arab states to help bring an end to the ongoing military campaign against it, but it is a lost cause. The regime has no true friends in the region, and it has itself to blame. For almost five decades, the Ayatollahs have pursued an expansionist policy of exporting the revolution and forward defense. But what Iran thought was a winning strategy to consolidate long-term leadership in the Middle East has backfired. Iran's rise was based on exploiting issues like the Palestine question and the marginalization of Lebanon's Shiites. Iran's model presented Tehran as a mentor and patron, incubating armed groups under the pretext of fighting just causes. In reality, Iran's proxies relied on the same oppressive behavior as that of the Tehran regime. For years, Iran's strategy appeared to be working. Iran-backed groups became the strongest actors in their countries. The seeming success of Lebanese Hezbollah, the first proxy Iran nurtured, became a template for others in the Middle East. But the expansion of proxies created vulnerabilities for Iran and its assets. With no domestic space for critique and the suppression of outside opponents, there were no checks on the regime's behavior. Tehran grew blind to its brittleness, believing it could outmaneuver the U.S., Israel, the Arab countries, and the international community. This included negotiating an international nuclear deal while it was enriching uranium beyond the level necessary for civilian use, and thinking it could withstand the consequences of Hamas' October 7, 2023 attack on Israel. Blindness also led Tehran to overestimate its friendship with Russia and China. Tehran saw Moscow as an ally when it intervened to prop up Syria's Assad regime in 2015. But Russia saw instead an opportunity to grow its influence in that country, consolidate its military presence on the Mediterranean, and stand up to the West. Iran and China, for their part, struck a 25-year cooperation deal in 2021. But what Tehran viewed as rising global sway, China saw as a limited economic pact. Beijing subsequently stalled the agreement's delivery. Today, neither Russia nor China will come to Iran's rescue. Beijing has always avoided getting involved in Middle East conflicts and remains focused on its Indo-Pacific backyard. Moscow's bogged down in Ukraine and is prioritizing the years-long conflict there, which has only escalated in recent months. Nor will Iran's proxies save it. Israel has decapitated Hezbollah's leadership and destroyed much of its missile arsenal, and the group would lose much of its remaining domestic support if it drags Lebanon into another war. The scale of the Houthis' remaining arsenal in Yemen remains a mystery, following a months-long campaign of U.S. air strikes. But they are constrained by de-escalation deals with Washington and Riyadh. Most of the Iran-backed Iraqi factions are also choosing self-preservation over involvement in an unwinnable battle with Israel and the U.S. Meanwhile, Syria has turned from a fertile ground to a hostile one for Iran and its assets after the Assad regime was toppled in December. Israel has framed its war on Iran as a boost to regional and global stability. Both the U.S. and Israel want the mission achieved, and while the Arab Gulf states have pursued rapprochement in recent years with Iran and are calling for de-escalation, that's largely a symbolic gesture. They will ultimately not stand in the way of a new Middle East and a weakened Iran. The regime, it seems, may be taking its last breaths and has no one to turn to. There's a photograph here, about an eighth of a page. It's very colorful. I'll read the caption. A boy waves an Iranian flag at a 2021 rally in Tehran, celebrating the 1979 revolution. Now, from back to front, this is a beautiful, clear blue sky. There's some kind of a building, or maybe it's a big billboard in the background. It's bluish in color. There are flagpoles standing in front of it with flags, and the boy is dressed in camouflage like a soldier would be, holding two flags, for the Iranian flags, horizontally from top to bottom, green, white, and red, with some type of an possibly Arabic symbol imprinted on the white band. And also showing next to this particular flag in the boy's right hand, missiles pointing toward the sky. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.